Moderator today. Thank you, Dory. I'm a PhD student at Stony Brook, but this is session 11.4. It's a country studies forum in case anybody's wondering. So we're going to hear from Eric Jensen, is that correct? The PhD student in economic history at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. This schedule prior to concerns trade unions in Sweden vis-a-vis Europeanization of the Swedish labor market. He's involved in politics and union politics and labor politics. And our next speaker will be Claire Sotheby. Is she not? Close enough. Who's a researcher at the Classifying Sulio Project, a PhD candidate at the University of Johannesburg in South Africa, and a socialist activist focusing on striking tactics. So if you want to come up with that, Aaron, we'll start. I'm going to hold questions till the end, if that's all right with everybody. Just keep this moving on.
I'm Eric Bengtsson, from the University of Gothenburg. And I work part-time at the university, and I also work part-time for the blue-collar trade union confederation in Sweden, which is called LO, which is the biggest union confederation. And I work for their Gothenburg office. So this paper is actually not my academic specialty, but it's more something that maybe grew out of. I can be honest and say that I'm a member of the party and I work for the union, so this is not an outsider, an insider perspective maybe. I'm trying to understand what's happening in the Social Democratic Party today, but also to relate it to, of course, a more general discussion about the crisis of social democracy in Europe and what possibilities we have for a new trend of social democracy and left parties. Well, I guess the basic starting points, the normative starting points, are like one is the big idea from Kolbe and so many others about what difference does it make to have a Social Democratic Party ruling compared to a bourgeois party. And I do believe that there are parts and effects. It does make a difference. So, and it's for the better. But I won't look so much at the outcomes in this paper. This paper is more about the second aspect, which is the more like political science thing about participation and democratic participation in itself, like being involved in politics and going to vote, being member of parties, which is, as this Verba and I and Kim write in his very influential book about participation and political equality, most democratic political systems are in principle equalitarian. They are based on universal suffrage, whereby each person has equal influence. In practice, it does not work that way. And in power resources theory of Kolbe and others, universal suffrage and the right to organize parties are the main power resources of the working class in a capitalist society, whereas the capitalist class would have power through their ownership of the means of production. So the working class must organize to be able to have a counter power to that. And what's even more depressing in that perspective is that still, if you look at what people become politicians and what people are most active in politics, it tends to be, in the Kampstein at least, more middle class or upper class people. And so it's even more unequal. It doesn't maybe work as it should work according to power resources theory, where democracy becomes a counter power to capitalist power, but it might work in tandem with capitalism. But those are the very high-level normative starting point. The more direct starting point is this issue of where is social workers going? And this really old question of the Irish law of bureaucratization and can a workers' party stay true to the ideals or whatever, or must it be transformed into, the political scientist Kirchheim said in the 60s that mass parties were transformed into catch-all cater parties, parties dominated by small cater and aiming at a general audience, not at the class, but that's, just been maximizing the number of votes. And so diluting ideology and, stressing getting power instead of the real achievements that the party was supposed to work for. And the SFP, Social Democratic Workers' Party, as it's called in Swedish, it's usually translated into just the Swedish Social Democratic Party, but the real name is Sveriges Socialdemokratiska Arbetarparti, which is Sweden's Social Democratic Workers' Party. Has been considered as the mass party par excellence, and so this is a political scientist, Niklas Eilert, he writes about, it's a SFPST, it's a mass party. And there's also a current challenge in Sweden over the concept of workers' party, as I guess as in most other Western democracies, parties crowd in the middle, try a bit like Hirschhammer said, try to maximize votes from all layers of society. And this is the current conservative Prime Minister of Sweden with a sign that says Sweden's new workers' party, which is ridiculous since the Conservative Party has always been, if you look at all the politicians, they've always been recruited from the top layers of society, like major company leaders, CEOs, capitalists, landlords. But they try to break into this concept too and attract workers' votes. So the SFP is kind of in a identity crisis, I guess. Attacks from the right, from a conservative party, which is the second biggest party in Sweden, claiming to be a workers' party, a party for those who work, unlike those lazy people who are unemployed and just collect benefits. And of course, all the discussion about deindustrialization and the weakening away of the traditional working class, and that Social Democratic Party must appeal to more than just the blue collars, they must widen their rights and so on. So my question in this study is what kind of position do blue collar workers actually have in the SFP today? Because I wrote an article with a unionist friend about on the topic, is social democracy still social democratic? The question was, the party is often criticized from the left for having betrayed its ideals and sold out, and it's not really social democrats and so on. But it's hard, what kind of measure do you use? What is real social democracy? What is the objective interest of the working class? How can you measure if a party lives up to that or not? I can't provide an objective measure. So in this paper, I just do the comfortable thing and use unions as a proxy for working class interests. So beware of that. But what I look at is how does the party relate to blue collar unions, not the working class in an objective way. And the background, class voting is traditionally rather strong in Sweden. So the Social Democratic Party has had a hegemony, I think, among workers, and a very tight connection with the blue-collar trade union corporation. So if you look at blue-collar workers and white-collar workers and how they vote, you see that all the time, the majority of blue-collar workers vote red. That is for the Social Democrats or for the left party. And Social Democrats are much bigger. And white-collar workers generally vote for other parties. But the differences are diminishing. So class voting is not as pronounced today as it used to be. And if you look at the blue-collar corporation, how do their members vote? And you see that the Social Democratic Party is dominant, completely dominant. The other parties are around between 0 and 10% during this period. And the Social Democrats always had more than 50%. And if you look at like how do they recruit their politicians, the class composition of the party group in the parliament is what I look at here. You can see that in 1943, according to Holmberg's specification, 33% of the parliamentarians from the Social Democratic Party came from a blue-collar job, whereas in 1988 it was only 13%. And the group that's been growing the most in the same period is the group of professional politicians, which means that if you look at the parliamentary group today, a very large group, minority in the Social Democratic group, are the job title is ombudsman, which means that they are officials in the union or in the party, but most often in the union. So why the blue collar working category declines so much is because the number of employees of the unions themselves have increased a lot, and they are employees of all ombudsmen, and they are counted as professional politicians in this classification, and that's a very large base from which the party recruits its top politicians. So they don't come from the factory floor immediately. First they make a career in the union, and then they may be recruited into parliament. And if you look at the current situation, there is an upcoming election in September. There's a general election every 4 years. So this is the results from the last election, where it is all the 7 parties in parliament from left, ranked from left to right. And this is how the LO members voted. So you see about 50% vote for Social Democrats, 9% for the left party, and small percentages for the other bourgeois parties, and 30% for the conservative, the New Workers' Party. But if you look at how are they recruited, the politicians of these parties, do they come from LO jobs, or do they come from middle-class jobs, or being company owners, CEOs or something? And then you can see that this percentage is much, much smaller. The left party only have one parliamentarian from an LO job. All the others are middle class, like teachers, social workers, like very, very typical middle class academic jobs. The Social Democrats have about one-fifth of their voluntarians say that they have a blue collar job. But then they have like 40% say they are ombudsmen. So they probably used to be blue collar workers, but they can't be the ombudsman way. And in other parties, it's really a tiny percentage that come from blue collar jobs. In the Christian Democrats, they have like a car mechanic and a nurse's aide, but those are pretty much the only workers in the other parties. Parliamentary groups. So it's very unequal, like the recruitment of politicians to the top level at least. I would say that Social Democrats are the only party that have a significant percentage of their politicians coming from blue collar jobs. The other parties don't care. They're not even the left party, which is really ironic. So there's been a lot of critique of like mini classification of the party. I wanted to look at some key issues, like where does this concept come from? Like, what kind of sources are there for the alienation between maybe the working class as represented by unions in the newspaper and the party? And I found it helpful, like this is really work in progress, so I've kind of reformulated my idea since I wrote these PowerPoints. But I would say that in the blue collar unions there are 3 different groups. There are like the public sector unions, which is a very big one, municipality workers. There are like work in childcare, in healthcare, in elderly care, that kind of stuff. That's the biggest union. And so obviously they have a great interest in preserving the public sector and keeping a high standard of welfare services. And in that part of the union, we've already seen like a drop of confidence once, and that is in 1998. You can see here that in 1994 it went up, how many of LO members voted for the Social Democrats. 98, it went down again. And many of them voted for the left party, which is this point, which is the only one that gets over 10% for any other party in this period. And that was because after the economic crisis in the early 90s, there were a lot of cuts in welfare services. And so a lot of welfare service workers were disillusioned by the Social Democrats Party and went to the left party, who at the time had a charismatic, strong, intelligent feminist leader who appealed to a lot of female group of workers. So that's one group. And that's already well known. That kind of rift between Social Democrats and the blue collar base. But then obviously there are two other types of unions. This is very informal. This is also because I work with unions, so I see what kind of political alliances there are within the unions. Industrial unions, they are actually, I would say, the one where there's no rift with the party so far. Because they have a lot of power. Like, the biggest union in Sweden today is municipality workers, the biggest blue team. But it used to be, up to 1980, it was the industrial workers, metal workers union. And so they still have their image that they are the biggest and most important, that they are the working class, because they are industrial workers. They are real workers. And they are very influential in the party. They are always top dog. If you have a parliamentary list that's going to be set, like in Gothenburg, where are you? And you know that the unions should have three of the six seats available. Then the metal workers always go first because they are they are top dog. So they are not disillusioned with the party, not the union at least. Maybe they're rank of five members, but in terms of party politics, they are kind of keeping their strength within the party. But then there's this third group, and that's the service sector union, private service sector. And this is the type of union today where there's most discontent with the party. Because the municipality workers, you could see them protest in 98, but I think since then it's turned back a bit. The party is more welfare state friendly today than it was in the 90s. But there's this third category of construction workers and shop assistants, truck drivers, taxi drivers. These kind of people are the most radicalized unions today. And so I interviewed people at these unions who are responsible for political work or political cooperation about this, and I tried to find out why. Because it's interesting, because there's this paper by two liberal economists, Andreas Berg and Victor Ellingsson, about what they call liberalization without retrenchment in the Swedish welfare state. They say that Sweden in the 80s and 90s went through a lot of deregulation, a lot of liberalization of, for example, railroads used to be state-owned, and now it's privatized, and you have a market for railroad traffic. And a lot, also taxi was deregulated, and the electric market, a lot of this stuff. And very nice some came, but this is a really good thing. The Swedish economy has become more efficient with this. And they say that there's a consensus. They see no discontent with this. Because they don't look at unions, of course, they are liberals, so they don't care about the unions. So they just see it as a completely good thing. Sweden has become more capitalist, so it's better. But if you talk to the unions, I think you can trace some of the discontent with the party in these evolutions. Like the Transport Workers Union, it's probably the most leftist mainstream union in Sweden. They organize truck drivers and cargo workers and bus drivers and taxi drivers and so on. And their political representative, he talks about, and he's involved in the party and everything, so he's a mainstream guy, but he talks about a real workers' party must stop the illusion of a pure service sector proletariat, of people who work full-time but can't live on their wages. And that's where we're going at press speed. And of course, this is something that happened under the Social Democratic government too. And he talks about that in the 60s and 70s, the manufacturing sector was globalized. like, so the method workers, so those industrial workers, they have to live, learn to live with, you know, no wage competition from Portugal, Finland, and Vietnam, and then South Korea, Japan, China, and so on. So they are used to it. They do not oppose globalization or so on. But what's happened in the last 20 years maybe is an inflow of cheap labor into Sweden. So even the service sector jobs are now facing low wage competition, but in our own country. So that construction work that must be done on site. And these unions are not used to this. So they have become radicalized in, you know, facing this situation. And especially like EU enlargement in 2004, when eight post-communist countries joined the EU and got free access to EU labor markets. This was very controversial in these units, but nothing like metal workers, because they already adjusted. And what Virelius says from transport side is that there's no difference here between the Social Democratic Party and the Conservative Party. Doesn't make a difference who you vote for. And then I talked to SEKO, this is the communications workers. They organized like railway workers, this kind of stuff. They were also heavily deregulated in the 90s. And their political representative, political ombudsman, he talks about that before we couldn't even spell to new public management. We thought it was a good thing. We thought that, you know, a market, making the public sector work more like a market would help us raise our wages. We thought that it was a good thing. And what we see now is that the companies just want profits, and how they do it is that they, you know, make workers work harder and, you know, deliver worse quality. So they turn around, and but they are still, I think, say it's an important political turnaround, because the nurses and the municipality workers have done exactly the same experience. In the 80s, they were also positive about privatization of, like, childcare and stuff, because they thought that that would help them, more competition among employers would help them get better wages. But after a while, they've seen that maybe it didn't really work out for them. But CFO, they are more optimistic still about the party, and that it's still, there's still a difference between that party and the Conservatives. So I guess my hypothesis is that you can see, unfortunately, we can't see how people vote by the union affiliation. You can only see it on confederation level, not on like how the transport workers vote compared to municipality workers. But I think it's one of the things we can see that the private sector blue collar workers don't vote for the social democrats in the same extent that the public sector blue collars do. So I do think that there is a growing discontent among private sector service workers, and this is very, very problematic for the Social Democratic Party, because they lose legitimacy if their policies don't make a difference for workers compared to if the Conservatives rule, then, you know, they would be more apathy probably. That's lower turnout, the votes, and also less votes for the party. But the party strategy, all these privatizations and deregulations had a consumer perspective, of course. They were not made to enhance the working conditions of the people working in sectors. They are a minority. But people using electricity and taxis and buses and railroads, they are a majority. So the party had a consumer perspective, I think, and that it would be better service, and then, you know, if people had to work for it, that was not their focus. So there's a conflict there between looking at workers or looking at consumers. And I think the mainstream party strategy is that we must focus on the middle class. That's how you win elections. Because a lot of people go to university today and blah, blah. And we can't just look on the old blue collar workers. So you do see among some, only the private sector, I would say only the private sector service unions, that they are definitely at the left of the party and more like demanding more socialist policies. The municipality workers, no. And the industrial unions, definitely not. They are pretty happy with the party as it is. But you see a growing discontent here. So that's, you can just speculate on what will this mean. I mean, there is an election in September. And the red-green coalition of social democrats, left, and green parties have been leading in the polls the entire period. But right now it seems that it's turning around and they might actually lose another election to the conservative coalition. And then, you know, it's a real crisis for the workers' movement in Sweden, I think. I have another section about more renewed methods of working politically, but I will leave that out because of time constraints.
We may be able to go back.
Yeah.
A question
conceptualize certain kinds of non-standard work, non-employment work around Soweto. And let me start off with, we went along to try and understand something about the labor force in Soweto. And in South Africa, the government has a very strange way of calculating unemployment, which firstly, since the end of apartheid, which says that if you have not looked for a job within the 2 weeks before they do their survey, you're not unemployed. And also, if you're doing any kind of what they would call economic activity, which would include people who set up a table literally this big on the side of the street with a handful of sweets on it, and they sell them for 1 cent a sweet or whatever, you know, so really just very makeshift work, even those people, because they did that, they counted as unemployed. So we went along to try and see what is the real situation of what's going on. The first thing that we came up against was the realization that this binary of saying that everything is employed or unemployed is totally unsatisfactory for a country like South Africa, and this might apply to the rest of the world. I can't speak with any authority, but probably to many parts of Africa, parts of South America and so on. And this is basically what we found of the how Soweto shapes up in terms of these things. Now, the obvious categories, people who are employed by someone else in a standard job where they have no managerial power, any kind of employment, so this includes domestic work, but employed full-time or part-time on a regular basis was almost a quarter. This very small amount here is people who were actually middle class. We counted them as employed middle class, meaning that they were in some kind of supervisory or managerial role. So they had some kind of power over the work process. That's a very small slice, as you can see. People who are unproblematically unemployed. They're unemployed, they don't do anything else, they have no other form of activity. That was a full quarter. People who are self-employed in self-employed and, if you like, successful at it. So this category, which is about 6%, people who are, for example, small shopkeepers, maybe running family businesses, sometimes employing other people, but the definition here is when you ask them, would you accept a job in the next 2 weeks if someone offered you one, they said no, so they're satisfied with their activities. Students, this category is both school students and university students, so I wouldn't count them as a class in any sense, but that was just over 12%. Pensioners, people on disability grants, full-time housewives, people who look after children as their main activity, which was an incredibly small proportion, actually answered yes to those last two activities, was about 10%. And then the other thing that we discovered, and this is maybe what's good news, these two categories, partial workers, we called them at full end. Now, basically, this was people who, partial workers who do work for other people. In other words, they're employed, but their work is extremely irregular. They tend to work for different people at different times, or else they're doing work that is really on the margins of society. So, for example, scrap collecting, where people literally walk around the streets picking up rubbish that can be recycled and then selling it on to a recycler, but it's just next door to a kind of self-employment. And in this category, fill-ins, now we call them fill-ins, which was a term that somebody used. This is the category of people with, the little table on the side of the street, who are selling and so on. So they're very much like the petty bourgeois shopkeeper, except that there are people for whom these activities that they're doing are not, as far as they're concerned, actually making a living. They're simply filling in while they wait for real employment. And this was the description that somebody gave of what they were doing. And there's, you'll see in the photos that I'm going to run in between the slides, I'll actually just let those go, you'll get an idea a little bit of some of what, some of the kinds of things that people are doing to try and survive. Now, the issue that comes, in that thing, we unfortunately weren't able to distinguish between people on casual work, contract work, and permanent work, because the survey was actually about all sorts of other things, and we couldn't cover everything. So, unfortunately, that thing is left out. But the issue really that I'm now trying to look at with regard to this is, what does it mean for class? What class are those categories of people, both that very large percentage of unemployed people, as well as the fill-ins and the partial workers and so on, how do we conceptualize the class of those people? And within academia, the debate that we come to within this is firstly that there's an argument about the fragmentation of the proletariat that I'm sure all of us come across. That somehow in new conditions things are fragmented. There's also an argument regarding a polarization of the labor market in South Africa, where people are saying that you now have a division of the working class into a privileged labor aristocracy of people who've got permanent work, and then everyone else who's in informal work, self-employed and so on, who are somehow marginalized and on the outside of society. And the issue isn't just within academia, but that also within Soweto. The common conceptualization of class in Soweto is that you've got at least two classes in the township itself. There's an upper class that's often outside of the township. Within the township, there's a middle class, which is sometimes also called the working class. People with jobs who've got an income, and then there's a deprived group, who are people understood to be unemployed, or within these marginal activities, who are living in shack settlements and very poor and so on. And the issue became even more practical in my own experience in a meeting of the Soweto Strike Support Committee during a strike of retail workers, which was significant partly because it was one of the first major strikes where casualized workers, most of them cashiers, but where casualized contract workers actually came out of a strike alongside permanent workers. So that in itself was significant. It to some extent began to overcome this divide that had developed, but where one of the workers stood up and said in the meeting, the biggest problem we're facing is unemployed people, when we're picketing, they just push past us and go on into shop. They don't understand what it's like to work. So all these new divides that appear to be developing between casual and permanent, unemployed, employed, and so on. So that's how I get onto this question about trying to conceptualize these groups. Now, of course, one of the easiest ways to try and do it is to say that unemployed and so on are merely displaced workers. Okay, this appears to be a Marxist concept. Now, the reason I think we have to look at this again and think harder about it is that some of the people in our survey have never worked, and we don't know if they ever will. And many of them used to have work, but have lost work, have been unable to find new work, and may never work again. So that experience, I think you can't really just conceptualize it as being a temporarily displaced worker. It doesn't really understand things properly. And doesn't really answer this question about whether wage work therefore confers some kind of privilege. Now, the second thing we then looked at in terms of this question of worker privilege was firstly to try and say, okay, you might go to work and you sign your contract as an individual. Obviously, you're not an individual when it comes to working, you're part of a collective. But also, workers are not islands. Outside of work, you have this whole sphere of what Marx sometimes talks about as reproductive labor, which is, in other words, the work of producing workers, if you like, of producing ourselves, if you want, and our daily lives. And obviously that sphere, which is very often the sphere of the household, you might talk about it as a sphere of consumption, but I think it's broader than that. But we wanted to look at things, therefore, in the sphere of the household. And what we found, firstly, is that being the privileged worker who has a wage, in fact, in South Africa with unemployment growing, sometimes is less of a privilege and more of an increased burden as your unemployed relatives and friends and children and aunties and uncles come and start to rely more and more on that small wage for their support and so on. And this table here gives some idea of how, now it says households, obviously, so this is not a percentage of households, but these are percentage of people in our surveys, what were the different kinds of households they were in. And we divided it up basically amongst these three main categories, that are three main ideas, employment, unemployment, and other kinds of gaining an income through self-employment, through pensions and so on. The first thing that we discover is the vast majority of people, 45%, are in households that have some kind of mixture of employment and unemployment. So it supports this idea that most workers are supporting unemployed people, and most unemployed people are supported by someone who is in a wage in some way. We're also seeing that if you add several of these categories together, the ones where these are all categories where somebody is employed in the household, that's about two-thirds of all the households are in that kind of situation. And I'll just read you a typical household situation that we came across when we were talking to people. There's a woman, she's a textile machinist. She calls herself middle class. She lives in a household together with her brother, who lives in the garage of the same house. Her daughter and her sister's child live in outside rooms. The daughter works as a data capturer, but she's on contract work, occasional work with agents. The brother works as a driver. Her sister's child, who also lives with her, is not working. Her son was working in a retailer as a contract worker, and now he's not working anymore. He sometimes does part-time work laying tiles within people's bathrooms as households and so on. And it was quite funny because she tried to then set us up to hire him. She was like, you need any tiling work done, you know, trying to get a little bit of extra money. This group of people, they don't put their money together, but they help each other out, especially the two boys, helping them out with buying their clothes and so on. And she also gives money to her other sister who lives elsewhere, because she's also not working. And that sister hasn't worked since 1984. She was working in a factory as a clerk. She sometimes gets temporary work in a richer office area of Johannesburg, and the person puts it only for a week, then for 3 weeks she sits at home. And she says, I want my son to get a job, and I also want my sister to get a permanent job so she can maintain her children. But you can see very clearly what's going on here is that she's, the fact that she's a permanent worker with a wage has actually brought these extra responsibilities onto her rather than making her privileged. You can see that there's this 5% of people who were in households where everyone in the household was employed. And we're talking here only about households with more than one adult. So one adult households are excluded from this. So if there is this privileged minority that doesn't get a work burden, it's a terribly small percentage. But what we also see from this is that this part of the table is people where nobody is employed. Okay, people are either doing makeshift work. They might be part of that small section that we call petty bourgeoisie, you know, small shopkeepers who are successful and so on, but for the most part, this is people who are either unemployed, surviving on little bits of work here and there, filling work, or on old age pensions in particular. particular, which is one of the ironies about South Africa, is that having an old age pension, which is a tiny amount of money, actually makes you a bit of a commodity in your family, that you can be a source of income. And we find that there's a 4% of families, which to me is actually quite an astonishing number, nevertheless. There's nobody who works in that household. So for an urban area, that's actually quite high. So the question becomes, okay, we could say that people in these categories are somehow kind of, if not displaced workers, at least people who are somehow part of the working class because they're supported by the working class. And that might work to some extent, but then we still have to say, how do we categorize or class those people who are informally employed, who are the fill-ins, and the people in unemployed houses where nobody is actually working. Now, what we found when we looked at this, we concluded that actually these people should still be mostly conceived somehow as part of the working class, and we started looking at Marx, at the sections where he writes about what he calls the reserve army of labor, or the surplus population, or just the labor reserve. And actually, it was quite uncanny. I'd advise you to go and read the descriptions. But we really felt like we were reading about Soweto when we read his description of the different sections of the labor reserve. And what we found in looking at, can we talk about those people as a labor reserve? But some people would say you can only be a labor reserve if you're in and out of work. Okay, so this is very often a Western interpretation of the thing. And one theorist, for example, says, you can't use the concept anymore because people are out of work, are never going to work again, and therefore they're not a labor reserve. Okay, what we find is that most of these people actually are still, even if they never are going to work, there are people who are available for work. They're available to capital if it should expand suddenly or need a new kind of worker. They're available and looking for work. They aspire one way or another to work. So, for example, it was very common for us to meet people who were in these informal activities. One guy, he had quite a lot of capital. He cut hair on the side of the road. He owned a tent. He had a battery. He had this whole wheelbarrow full of equipment. So, you know, he was tending, in my view, towards a sort of small entrepreneur. And at the end of the interview, I said to him, is there anything you want to say to us? And his answer was, you must find me a proper job. So this is something that we find over and over again. People say, yes, I'm doing this kind of work, but it's not really work to me. What I really want is to be employed. So we find a whole section of people who aspire to employment, who feel that the jobs they're doing are not really successful in any way. And we also find a whole ladder of people who are, especially amongst those categories, the 4% where nobody is working, are very often people who spend most of their lives working, then lost their jobs there's been three big waves of retrenchments in the last 15 years, lost their jobs in retrenchments or restructuring of industry, geographic restructuring, where they've moved away from Soweto and have been unable to find employment subsequently. And it's in a sense the dumping ground, if you like, of the people who are no longer needed by industry just get thrown onto the shoulders of people still in work, and if there's no one whose shoulders they can land on, they're basically left to their own devices to starve or get by very badly. So to get back into Marx's concept, this concept of the reserve army of labor, try and see how this fits in with all of this. Now Marx talked about, some people say he's being functionalist about it, because at some point he says capital can't function without a surplus population. So it creates this idea that people say that capital goes and creates the surplus population, and then what people say to me in South Africa is that actually it's not functional for capital, because it's created such huge poverty and unemployment. Crime is going up, the level of violence within crime is becoming a real problem, that actually it's problematic for capital, and therefore Marx must be wrong about this whole theory that he came up with. My reading of it is that actually he's talking about it, that this, what he calls a surplus population, it's not his own choice of word. It's actually a word that was used by reformers at the time, saying, oh, there's this huge problem, the unwashed masses are producing too many babies, and it's creating the surplus population, which is creating problems in the cities. And Marx is debunking that. He's saying actually the surplus population is a byproduct of the way that industry develops. It's an inevitable byproduct. And it's a byproduct for many reasons, because capital develops in fits and starts. It grows suddenly, then it stops, then it restructures, old industries die, new industries are created. So after an initial process of proletarianization, where proletariat is created, you get a section of people who are separated from any other means of making a living, but they're not necessarily finding an alternative means of making a living when they become unemployed. So he talks about it as a byproduct of the development of industry, but at the same time as something that enables capitalism to develop, not in a functionalist way, but in the sense that if there wasn't this group of people who were more numerous than the number of job opportunities available, then actually industry wouldn't be able to develop in an unfettered way. It would keep coming up against this problem if it makes a sudden expansion, where are we getting new labor from? But it's actually more than this now. Just to go back a second. So one of the things he talks about is, when we looked at that table of households, is how this section of the proletariat is actually thrown onto the shoulders of the working class. That, in other words, working people are subsidizing, keeping unemployed people or subsidizing their own selves while waiting to see if they can get employed or if their kids can get employed or supporting those who were employed and are now rendered redundant by the development of industry. But he also mentioned some other things that we're seeing in our research, which is that this surplus population works as a kind of elastic in the labor market. So one of the ways we saw this, it's a very common work trajectory for young people in South Africa today, is that your first job is going to be part-time work, especially in a retailer, over Christmas, for example, when everything's very busy, they need a couple of extra workers, you get brought in for Christmas, and then you're out again. So very often that's the first experience of work that young people will have, and sometimes, in fact, older people are also used in this way, being pulled into that and then pushed out again. We also saw earlier that it's very much a dumping ground for redundant workers, such as you saw the person from SEMA talking earlier about how they used to work and none of them are any longer working. But it also seems to me that there's an additional use that's coming out, which Marx only he hints at. I think it's the beginnings of the arguments is there. But that actually it's about, if you like, retooling labor for new requirements. Okay, and the way that he talks about it is the move from home industry, hand industry, to some kind of manufacture. That actually one of the ways that that's achieved is not by taking the people already in work and training them for new kinds of work, but by just throwing them out of work and taking in a whole new section of people, and they get trained up in these new kinds of work. And I think in the modern world, one of the forms of that we see, of this retuning of labor, is not so much about actual skills, but about accepting worse working conditions. And that's one of the main things that seems to be happening with young people who are being pulled in with no other experience of work. Just at the time when apartheid was ending, when a whole lot of protections for permanent workers had been won at the end of apartheid, but at the same time, suddenly this whole new form of work coming in of saying, actually, don't expect a job for life. Don't even expect a job for the week. You come and go as we want you to. So that's one of the things that's happening. And to finish off, I think one of the things, that kind of polarization and differentiation that a lot of academics are pointing to, are saying this represents, this fragmentation of the working class, new classes developing and so on. It seems to me that this actually is one of the major levers there is to some extent. Okay, there's a big middle ground where the new conditions of work create new dependencies, but there is also a polarization of some who are totally pushed to the bottom and some who do seem to rise above the worst work conditions to get along okay. But actually that this is, in a sense, one of the whips that helped to drive this kind of restructuring. And one of the ways we saw it happening was that we found that people with the worst kinds of jobs tended to be people who were in households with the highest levels of unemployment. So we think one of the things that's happening is if you've got a couple of people employed in your family, you can afford to be unemployed for a bit. If nobody is working, you'll take whatever you can get. So it's one of the mechanisms by which capital has been driving down the quality of work and getting people to actually subsidize their own exploitation. And of course, even if you're in one of these better off jobs, you know, one of the things that we find is not just individuals whose jobs are getting downgraded and upgraded, moving around, but whole households will move up and down according to the constellation of employment. So even if you're in one of these better off jobs, you're constantly reminded that if you don't behave and keep your job and accept the new work conditions and so on, you might end up being one of those deprived people that everybody in the township has seen within the last 10 years, people going from average to into these really, you know, ending up in a squatter camp or falling down through the ranks. And therefore, there's, I think there's two implications of that for activists and how we try to conceive of these things. Firstly, I think one thing that I'm thinking about when you walk around South Africa, if you say working class, people don't understand by this the same thing that I understand, which would include all of these people who have nothing and who are forced to either rely on selling their labour or who wish to sell their labour, who would like to be able to do it. People don't think of that. They think if you've got work, you're working class. If you're unemployed, you're not. And maybe one way around this is to start thinking more about a word that Marx himself used was proletariat, which basically means propertyless class. In fact, technically it means you have nothing to sell except your children, apparently, from the old Latin word. So it's actually quite literal in the South African context. But also it shows us something about how the experience of being proletarian is not automatically pushes us towards unity with other proletarians. What binds us together, the fact that we only have our labour itself, can also be within the concrete conditions of capitalist labour markets, is sometimes also the thing that blinds people to their commonality. So leading people to think we're two separate classes, there's the workers and there's the unemployed, and I think really what it means is an even greater responsibility, if you like, on the shoulders of people like ourselves and people within the proletariat who are trying to be able to try and rise above your immediate experience of life, to look beyond the fact that here I am in the township and there's poor people there and there's just okay people here, and you know, try to develop some kind of theorization of our conditions and what puts us each in those positions before we can start to see the possibilities and the necessity of some kind of united action. So.
Discussions with the owners.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots. I mean, they haven't lost influence completely. I mean, they still, of course, have collective bargaining and like the right to be represented on the company boards and stuff. So,
oh, really?
But it's just that, like, I know people from the communications workers. So they were used to be railroad maintenance. That used to be a state company.
That within the total railroad company.
So that was a huge company, including like people driving the trains and repairing the trains, everything. That they had very large workplaces, so they had an immediate solidarity. Now they're splintered, so maintenance is like Euromaint, and it's owned by some German company, and it's maybe sold every 7 years to some other multinational company who, you know, always like restructure it. So
there's no workplace stability as it used to be. So that's why cooperation has been weakened. But I mean, they still have the same legal rights and everything, and it's no more disaster. I don't think, I think they lost some, maybe benefits are not so good anymore, but it's not like a disaster like I've seen with truck drivers or something, or taxi drivers, which are really hard to regulate since they work individually and, you know, they, their workplace is their truck. So it's the question of workplace solidarity is even harder there. So that's where you really have like social dumping today. That's, that doesn't happen in electricity or railroads.
I want to ask Claire, of the people who are employed more often than not, are most of them finding work actually in Soweto? Because I know there's a lot of like people who are sort of living one place in South Africa and then going to Johannesburg for like 6 months of the year. Is that a major part of what, you know, for the employment situation?
We didn't actually ask people in our survey where they work. I'm trying to remember an earlier survey done about 10 years earlier showed that something like, I think it was about 5% of people actually work within Soweto. And that's, you know, that's the whole history. The existence of Soweto was as a dormitory town to keep black workers outside of white areas but still be close enough to work. Having said that, I'm trying to, the biggest employer of working Swedes is government. So there is quite a large percentage. I think about, I've got the figure somewhere, I'll check it in a minute. I think it's about 20% are working as teachers, nurses, and so on. And many of them would be employed in Soweto. The other growing area where there's been a, one of the biggest changes in the townships has been the growth of shopping centres. Because you know, retailers have suddenly realised they've been missing all this disposable income, and they try to mop it up at source. So there is a growing number of people in retail who are employed in the township, but the vast majority of people who work are travelling at least as far as Johannesburg, which is what 20 km, and some people are travelling even further afield. You know, they'll be travelling up to 20 km a day to find whatever work they find. There was a big move of industry, light industry, that used to be on the outskirts of Soweto, that decamped from Soweto to the other side of Johannesburg, the East Rand, where they were being given all sorts of subsidies for coming and investing there. So a lot of those people that you saw talking about, we used to work and then industry moved to Benoni. That's exactly what happened to them. And you find some people now traveling, you know, all that way to try and keep their jobs. So I'd say in formal employment, it's most of it would probably still be outside.
I think the problems that Claire is dealing with are similar to what we're having here in the States in describing unemployment. Mm-hmm. The Center for Working Class Studies has started publishing last year what we call the de facto unemployment rate. And that really started to look at part of the government statistics that are usually not reported. They're called the U6, the statistics, if you go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you can see it. And so we started, and then we found a study that was done by the McKinsey folks, which was a very prominent consulting firm out of Boston, that had worked on the Swedish economy and found out that the unemployment rate in Sweden was much higher than what was being reported. So we took the same method. And we found out that the unemployment, the fact unemployment rate was probably 1.5 times what was being reported. Okay? Then we started to think about it a little more strategically. And in the U.S., we have a lot of people in prisons that are in prisons because they couldn't find work. So we started to abstract some ideas about prison populations. And then in our area, in Youngstown, where there's been high levels of unemployment, we know a lot of people joined the military. And there was a lot of fights over what constitutes a standing army. And we talked to Michael Zweig about some of his ideas about it, too. So we just said, well, we'll assume, I think, 2 million people as a standing army. And then you start, there's a whole set of other people that have been forced into retirement, okay, are disabled. And we came up with a figure of around 30%. Okay? Now, when we started publishing that, nobody gave a shit. Language, but they didn't. And then, but as this thing sort of picked up, first the manufacturing technology news picked it up, then the Wall Street Journal picked it up, and then the right wing picked it up in the country. And the reason the right wing picked it up is that they wanted to show that all the people that were getting some form of public assistance and the private sector was not producing enough jobs, and the public sector was creating more than more. So suddenly our little de facto unemployment rate starts circulating in circles that we never hoped or thought about, sort of the unintended consequences of just playing with numbers on this. But that's sort of one story. The other story is, I think, is really related to our discussion in a conference like this about class, and that's the question about an underclass. We call it, that's the term that we're trying to call it around here, or not, we're not necessarily calling it, but there's a distinction being made by working people of classes below them. And part of some of their conservative views are based on this idea of this permanent, growing underclass that's part of the increasing level of structural unemployment. That's some of the terms that the economists are using. And the increasing time in terms of frictional unemployment. But there is a struggle about what constitutes class and how it's being fragmented. And so when I heard your discussion today and sort of, you know, how complicated it is and problematic it is, it felt very much the same, because it's very difficult then to try to figure out all that lays out politically. It's crazy. Yeah.
I think, I mean, part of the problem, and Marx brought into it himself, was this sort of myth of the lumpen proletariat. There's a myth that there's people who are just not productive, who are living off of, you know, the fat of the land or whatever. Nobody is living, I mean, everybody who's eating and surviving is doing something, because it's impossible to live off of welfare or anything else. So I think that's the first, like, that false dichotomy between people who work and don't work. If you survive, if you're working in one way or another.
And there was also just last Friday in the New York Times, Robert Weiss, the former labor secretary, had an article that dealt with a report that came out from the Kauffman Foundation, which is a very conservative foundation, that one great thing about last year in the United States was that the level of entrepreneurship had increased 15%. And what Weiss said, what does entrepreneurship mean? It means self-employment. Okay, and it's like you'd call it the little tables out in front, and the people are trying to do, and those people are not being counted as unemployed. And it's a very fascinating article when you start seeing those type of arguments now appearing in the mainstream media, not just in the, because everybody's now questioning, especially in America, because our stock is going down, and we don't know how bad this recession / regional depressions are in the United States are going. They're starting to look at all that stuff and just trying to get a better take on what is actually happening in the economy. So, just some side.
I think one of the things that you brought up that was very interesting too was like the functional dimension of the Industrial Reserve Army, because even though it is a byproduct of capital, it's not, you know, it's not something that's engineered from above, but it certainly does serve the interest of capital by creating a chronic situation of insecurity among all working people. You know, nobody is really immune from the realization that they're one paycheck away from, you know, being a scrap metal collector.
How do students feel about it? I mean, a lot of you guys are younger folks. You know, how apprehensive now, or what would you expect in terms of taking your first job? Anything?
There's not a lot of academic work either. So, I mean, I'm living on the bare minimum we get to study for our comprehensive exams over the summer, which is nothing at all, and clawing back, work job after job after job in the academic job market. There used to be places for us to work in the summer, now there are not.
Yeah, I mean, speaking personally, I mean, like what I've been studying the MLA, the Modern Language Association, is the main job for English academics. And the conclusion I came to is that I'll move to whatever country I need to in order to get a job, and it probably won't be the United States. There's a good chance that it won't be the United States. That's we'll be driving a lot of international turnover.
Yeah, I mean, it's happening with the very normal now with the education sector. So people like me doing PhDs are worried about any kind of job afterwards.
What are your friends that have graduated? What are they doing? Are they finding academic jobs? Or are they finding jobs elsewhere?
Some of them. Yeah, but you have to do lots of short-term jobs, I think. That's the problem.
So you need multiple?
Yeah, but some of them are finding jobs.
A lot of adjunct people.
So if this is not this, like you're saying, like if they're going to get a job, it wouldn't be here, it would be somewhere else. Yet the crisis of capital is global. Mm-hmm. So where's it going to be? I mean, is there any maybe upswing in consciousness amongst the kind of people that move around like this, and that it is capital itself, and that there has to be some kind of changes to the system of capital?
I mean, speaking for literature people, most of us have been introduced to the idea, to some extent, you have to study Marxist theory in order to deal with it. There's no escaping that if you're studying literature, really. I mean, some people will study it and then hate it and talk about how stupid it is, but most people have at least some concept of it being a functional worldview. But I don't know if it's, I think the labor market is still very much just whatever we're going to find, we're just going to find something, we're going to find, and there's not much beyond the sort of low-level panic that exists at this point.
I mean, I think that's one of the big issues for me, is that just experiencing capitalism doesn't automatically make you conscious about it, and that's, you know, definitely one of the things, is that all of that panic, there's different ways you can deal with it. One of it is, you know, to go and look for a job elsewhere, which ironically, you come to South Africa, there's probably jobs for you there, but unfortunately, you need to the equivalent of action job loss. So it's kind of, it's a bit contradictory, but I mean, you're very welcome.
So again, getting those people in.
Exactly. And in South Africa, one of the big ways that it's been undermined any kind of real response, unified response, has been through anti-immigrant feeling, which has, you know, people might remember about 2 years ago there was a huge outbreak of anti-immigrant pogroms, and when I say anti-immigrant, it was African immigrants, you know, like white immigrants were immune because they lived in rich areas. But of course it was something that was also brewed at the top from a long, long series of, you know, like police raids on immigrants and harassment of immigrants and so on, which is also interesting in terms of the question of labor reserve and so on, that for a very long time, a lot of mining work in South Africa was initially done by people who were technically South Africans, but more and more started to draw people from the surrounding countries into that work. So actually our mines are built by a combination of Mozambican, Zimbabwean and South African miners. But of course, as things started to go down, the easiest way to deal with it is like tighten up on immigration. And I think that's probably quite an international phenomenon. So that's another one of the ways. And, you know, if you're living in a shack settlement, your daily experience is not to see the wealth of a place like Sandton, which is one of the richest areas. You know, you see it, but it's very distant from your life. And so very often people look around them and they say, I'm unemployed and here's this immigrant running a successful business just next door. What they're getting is that the guy was maybe a doctor back home and now he's selling sweets on the side of the road and he's got some cultural capital or whatever. But so very often that, you know, again, it's something that appears to be real if you've got a narrow view of life. But it looks like, well, the reason I'm not working is because he's got the job kind of thing, or he's taken that niche and so on. So I think that is one of the one of the reasons we can't just sit back and wait for capitalism to create a revolution. And so, you know, it's not necessarily going to happen. There's, it can also create a huge counter reaction. You know, and that's. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I actually had a question for you and a question for you. So, the question for you is your analysis of the what you talked about, the idea that it's a bureaucratization and the professionalization of the party, which is very interesting. What I wanted to hear you reflect about, do you think that was a kind of inevitable progression of parties, or does it have something to do with the particular kind of contradiction of social democracy, of trying to change things within the basic setup that it inherits, and in a time of crisis that more and more the kind of pressure of, you know, what you can do that would count as a small reform, it seems to me, gets... you know, small reforms get very much narrower when there's a crisis. So whereas if everything's growing, then a small reform might be universal social welfare to keep everyone quiet. But if there's a crisis, a small reform is nothing at all. So that was the question, if it makes sense. And then the question, when you were talking about the urban proletariat, which is actually when we first started looking at Marx, was to try and look at the urban proletariat. And in fact, that's you know, the lumpen proletariat in Marx is really just, he talks about prostitutes and thieves as being, and he's talking about a section that's just kind of totally broken by their experience, in a sense. But there's a bigger question for me, is this question that even if we're conceiving of a proletariat that's not only those in work, but at what point does, if unemployment continues to grow and grow and grow, and things continue in crisis, obviously if capitalism turns around and starts to grow a little bit again, find some way out of it, then a lot of people will get pulled back into work. But if that doesn't happen, and you get more and more people in this kind of unemployment, in South Africa there's a sort of worse form of unemployment, if you like, than what we see in Soweto, which is people who are just pushed out into these dumping grants in what used to be the bungee stars, the reserves, literally. And you're basically living in a squatter camp in the middle of nowhere, literally. There's nothing. You know, people grow a fruit tree in their backyard to eat. Somehow, I think people survive probably mainly on remittances from cities and so on, but I'm wondering at what point does it start to become a separate class, if you like, and you know, is there a point where that happens, or, and what would be the
implications
of that? So that is a question I'm
trying
to
do.
Why don't we start with
the heritage? If I answer your question correctly, we'll see. The bureaucratization was the event in general, or yes, for social democracy, because they tried to change the system of the labor market.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like inevitable or contextual,
definitely. Contextual in relation to
the fact that it's trying to change things.
Yeah.
Did you mean in the sense of that it was a social democratic, and so it was not trying to change the system, but just trying to gain some limited reforms while accepting the system of capitalism?
Yeah. I can see why that would imply a bureaucratization itself, but I think it was inevitable, okay, because. Well, at least it appears that way. I only studies I know of this problematic concern really early period of the party, like the late 19th century and really for like the first two decades of the 20th century. And they are mostly just looking at the ideas of why did it become reformists, like why did it stay revolutionary? And like, did they were the aristocrats dominate the party, was that the explanation? So I don't think you see any research on why. Because the statistics from Holberg show that, you know, ombudsmen and lepers, that they were the major group in the entire period, at least from the 30s. So there's not much change. I mean, it has, the number of lupina workers in oppositions has increased since the 80s. So that's actually a counter development in that direction. But I don't think it would be broken. So I don't think I can explain it because I don't know. In the Swedish case, there's no research in it, and I don't know the other cases.
It's not the same as it is in Soweto, but there are people are talking about reservations of race and class in urban areas. Now it's not exactly like what you're talking about because there are remittances from the government that sort of help, but very clearly, if you look at California, okay, and you study racial compositions. You'll see that most of the outlying urban areas are multiracial and multi-ethnic, but there are these reservations within, and I've seen these sort of little round circles all through California, that are, they call them reservations of race and class. They're poor and they're actually black. In Southern California, they're more Latino, or there are also more Latino. But they are clearly densely populated, high levels of poverty. And they're distinct from the other areas. It's one of the reasons why class has suddenly become a big issue, because you can have a great deal of diversity and have, at the same time, enormous inequalities in terms of class. And so, again, it's not the same that you described as, what was the term again? For these reservations? It's a very powerful sort of term. Because it then, when you use it in discourse around here, that's, you know, God, there are parts of America that are like South Africa and so on. So that's helpful right there. But I think there's a whole discussion, you know, that's really started to happen, and we're in advanced capitalist countries, where all those sort of class confusions are pretty strong right now, and they're being contested in various ways by various groups and being used in various ways. Everybody from Tea Partys to the leftists that are sort of fighting out over that terminology and doing those types of descriptions. But again, I'm so much interested in what happens to these students, you know, about their experience right now, because it is scary, you know? Because I have to deal with a lot of students who their professors have told them, no, don't worry, things are great. You're gonna have to work 5 jobs by the time you're 35. You're gonna gain all these powerful experiences, all this crazy, right? You guys heard that number? And I said, I want to talk to you at 35. I want to see what it's like when you had these multiple jobs. And what type of experiences did you really get? And by the way, how's the family doing? Do you have health care? Have you done anything in pensions and stuff like that? And that's what sort of, you know, there's a lot going on with younger people, but how they're articulating that, it's not clear. I think somebody asked, how are people feeling about it? How is that playing out politically? And it's almost like they don't have a vocabulary to discuss that experience. So that's one of my interests. I'm not trying to point you off. I just wanted to give a chance.
I don't want to go off that topic too much, but just to get onto the Bantus Dam, please, for a second, because there was an interesting documentary called Roger and Me, Michael Moore, and he showed, you know, in Flint, Michigan, as the jobs left in that. There are actually like sectors of the country and the economy that have moved away from a money market entirely, where people are like now bartering. There was one woman who was like killing rabbits and then trading. And so you have people who were like the sort of deproletarianization, I guess, or the movement of people out of the whole wage labor arena into these so-called more primitive forms of exchange and that. So that, I think, makes the to talk about the working class, you know, as you people who more and more don't even have the experience of exchanging their labor power for wages.
I'd just like to make a note. We have 5 minutes left, so if anybody wants to, please just be aware of that when you're making comments. I'm not speaking specifically to you. It's just Larry.
Well, I would be curious to know this whole idea of the are people being politicized and they don't have a vocabulary. To have a vocabulary, you really need to look at history, you need to plan an organizational structure that to provide that vocabulary. Is there anything like that happening?
Yes and no.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, in the sense that there is, you saw a couple of the people in the photos are interviewed on a march against prepaid commuters, march against elections. So that was with, there had been pretty much a universal boycott of payment for water and electricity under apartheid, by the end of apartheid. And with the end of it then comes also this campaign that there's privatization going on at the same time, and this campaign to get people to start paying again, which is put under the words of saying that, well, you know, now we can pull everything together. So, you know, kind of a double-edged sword. And there was quite a significant organization that developed around that, was the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, which was one of what we called the New Social Movement. The problem was it grew quite quickly to a certain point and then kind of got stuck. And the thing, it still exists, it's still active. People have done a lot of, what people do now is simply to go and illegally reconnect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been this kind of battle that goes on that the state is then, and local government is coming back with more and more sophisticated means of cutting people off. One of which is prepaid meters, which means you cut yourself off instead of someone coming and disconnecting you. So it individualizes things. But it still exists, but the hurdle that hasn't quite gotten over is the hurdle of the loyalty to the ANC. So it was the African National Congress, which it's a group of people who mainly actually were ANC supporters very often. And they were like the advance guard of people who said, we voted for this government, we did everything to put it in power, and they're now treating us like dirt, you know. But the sort of next wave of it, or their ability to rise above that, to be able to link up with people who are still loyal to the ANC, or our ability, let me say, because I'm also part of the movement, we haven't quite gotten over that hurdle. So they kind of got that far, and because of that, it's remained limited in size. So one of the things that's a question, one of the things that we're waiting to see, there's now a lot of upheaval inside the ANC. And there's a big question in our minds, where will that go? You know, will people start to now, the way it's been diffused in the meantime was by deposing Thabo Mbeki, who was like the president of neoliberalism,
mm-hmm.
And replacing him with Jacob Zuma, who is shaping up to be a different version of the same thing. You know, he's not at all exactly the same. He's trying to practice a different form of, you know, I don't know if you'll call it neoliberalism or some new form of it and so on, but there really is a question of that kind of critical mass, that if we aren't able to break out of that kind of ghetto of, you know, being this, like, sort of very left in terms of government rhetoric, in terms of rhetoric towards the government. It doesn't mean that everybody is a socialist within there, or, you know, this full of conservative ideas. So there is resistance, but it's coming up against a lot of strategic questions about being able to relate to people who haven't had the same experience as us, you know, or, you know, who are finding it difficult to pay but still want to be legal, for example. You know, so being able to talk to people who don't think exactly the same as you do is the thing that we've, I think, not quite succeeded in. But I think you're absolutely right. There are organisations that put forward a bigger vision of things, you know, and a bigger view about, say, what is putting us in our different places. What is the one thing that puts us all in these different strata within the proletariat? Without that, it's not automatic at all.
So we're about out of time. Thanks very much, everybody.